Welcome to the 11KPW podcast on the role of a data processor and data protection officer by Heather Emerson. This talk was given at the 11KPW General Data Protection Conference on the 13th of October 2016. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kpw.com.
For some time now, data protection law has, of course, drawn a distinction between a data controller on the one hand and a data processor on the other. That is a distinction which recognises that not all organisations involved in processing personal data have the same degree of responsibility or control over that processing. Historically, it's been the position that the data controller carries responsibility for processing and is liable in the event of non-compliance with data protection obligations. And there's been no direct liability imposed on the data processor. That is a feature of the directive and is translated into the UK's data protection regime. Historically, of course, a data processor has been liable primarily by way of contract to the data controller. Now, the regulation has fundamentally changed that position and now imposes direct obligations on data processors for the first time, with the effect that they will have direct legal obligations in respect of personal data they process, breach of which may expose them to hefty fines and claims from data subjects for unlawful processing. And that really marks a paradigm shift in the legal framework in relation to data processors. So starting with definitions, who is a data processor? It's defined in Article 4.8 as a natural or legal person, public authority, agency or other body which processes personal data on behalf of the controller. In short, it maintains the same definition as the directive. And of course, the key distinction between the controller and the processor is that it is the controller who is determining the purposes and means of processing. The processor is acting on behalf of and in accordance with the instructions of the data controller. Now, plainly, this is envisaged as a scenario where the data controller is contracting out the processing of data to another entity. And indeed, the regulation makes specific provision for the processor to become a controller if they go outside of the scope of the instructions given by the data controller and themselves start trying to determine the purposes and means of processing. Now, in practice, that distinction can be really quite difficult. There isn't really a material change from the directive, so the ICA's very helpful guidance on trying to get through that distinction is likely to remain relevant. And whilst there will be some entities which will almost certainly be included within the definition of data processor, such as data storage or data archiving companies, there's going to be a difficult judgment call to make on a wide range of other entities. Another interesting issue just to flag up is there had been some debate about whether an employee of a data controller could actually be a data processor on a literal meaning of the regulation, because, of course, they are processing on behalf of the data controller. Personally, I think that such an interpretation is unlikely, given that the scope of Article 4.8 has got to be determined and interpreted in accordance with the EU principle of proportionality. And it's also quite hard to square with the regime that relates to data processors in the regulation as a whole. For example, the detailed provisions about the contract between the data processor and the data controller. Turning to the key provisions in relation to the relationship between the controller and the processor, Article 28 is the key provision on that issue. And there are four key points that I think are important to understand. The first is that Article 28.1 imposes an obligation on the data controller to use processors that are providing, quote, sufficient guarantees to implement appropriate technical and organisational measures in such a manner that processing will meet the requirements of the regulation and ensure the protection of the rights of the data subject. So classic Euro babble, but in reality, it imposes a relatively high duty of care on data controllers in selecting their data processors. And before engaging a data processor, a controller will need to be satisfied that the arrangements in place are satisfactory and comply with the regulations. The second point in Article 28.3 is that there is a legal framework for processing, and there are a number of matters which must be spelled out in any contract or any other legal provision which governs the relationship between the controller and the processor, including the subject matter and duration of the processing, the nature and purpose of the processing, the type of personal data and categories of data subject, and the obligations and rights of the controller. So fairly extensive prescription in relation to the contents of the contract, which are then fleshed out in more detail within the regulation. Article 28.7 makes provision for the Commission or national supervisory authorities to set out standard contractual clauses. Now, it remains to be seen exactly what will happen in that respect in a post-Brexit world, but of course it may be that there'll be some flesh on the bones of what is required by way of those contractual provisions in due course. The third important point is that Article 28.2 prohibits data processors from engaging other processors without consent of the controller, either specific or general written consent. Of course, that's designed to safeguard against the subcontracting of work to third parties unless authorised by the controller. Finally, the fourth point is that where a processor does seek to engage another processor to carry out some activities on its behalf, the same obligations as are set out in the contract between the controller and the processor must be mirrored in the processor-processor arrangements, which is designed to ensure that the protections are not diluted through subcontracting or outsourcing of the data processor's obligations. And importantly, the processor will remain fully liable to the data controller for the performance of the obligations. So that sets the legal framework. In terms of direct obligations imposed on the data processor, there are a number of important points. Article 30 requires written records of processing activities to be carried out in respect of each, subject to an exception for certain organisations who employ less than 250 people, again, subject to certain exceptions in respect of processing what might be loosely called sensitive data, the data caught by Articles 9 and 10. Article 31 imposes a duty to cooperate with supervisory authorities. And Article 32 is a really important provision which relates to the security of personal data and requires every data processor to implement appropriate technical and organisational measures to ensure a level of security appropriate to the risk of processing and to ensure that any persons acting under its authority do not process except in accordance with instructions. So quite important provisions in terms of security. There's a duty under Article 33 to notify a data breach to the data controller. So note there not a duty to notify any data subjects directly or indeed any relevant supervisory authority. It's just a duty to report to the controller. And Article 37 requires data processors to appoint DPOs or data protection officers, and I'll turn to that in a minute. So reflecting on this package of obligations, they are reasonably wide-ranging and cover technical issues such as security arrangements, regulatory arrangements such as cooperation with supervisory authority, and governance issues such as written record keeping and a DPO. Ultimately, however, the consequences in the event of breach really do provide the sting that we find in the regulation. So turning to consequences in the event of breach, data processors now are liable to pay significant fines and damages where they breach the obligations under the regulation. Now, I know that enforcement issues are being dealt with in some detail later, so I won't deal with them extensively at this stage, but just to highlight for you three important points in the context of data processors specifically. First, there's a right for any person who has suffered material or non-material damage as a result of breach of the regulation to seek compensation against a data processor. And the processor will be liable where either it's not complied with its own obligations under the regulation or it's acted outside the scope of the lawful instructions of the controller. So there are two hooks for liability on the part of the processor: breach of the regulation or breach of instructions from the data controller. So if we just take an example of this, just to give it a bit of colour, imagine a data processor is a data storage company responsible for maintaining in an electronic, an encrypted form, personal data on behalf of a controller. Now that data storage company has got appalling security and leaves its door wide open, and it hasn't actually in fact stored any of this information on encrypted hard drives. And someone comes in, steals the hard drive, and publishes the information on the internet. There are two potential bases for liability here. One is direct breach of the regulation in terms of security requirements imposed by Article 32, and then the second basis arises from breach of any particular instructions or contractual obligations owed in respect of the data controller. So that's how that seems to operate in practice. The second important point is that the regulation envisages a form of joint and several liability in Article 82.4. So where there is more than one controller or processor, or a controller and a processor, and they're involved in the same error, the same mistake that leads to damage caused by breach, then they're both in principle liable for the entire damage. Of course, those provisions are aimed at ensuring effective compensation for the data subject. Now, of course, reflecting on that, there will obviously be a need to negotiate carefully any liabilities and indemnities in the contractual arrangements between the controller and the processor. Article 83 deals with administrative fines, which might be imposed on data processors in very significant amounts, a prospect that might well, in practical terms, impact on the future pricing of contracts for data processing services. And I know that fines are going to be dealt with later. So, summarising really the practical implications of what is quite a technical area, there is no doubt that the regulation exposes data processors to a more onerous and more intrusive regulatory regime than that currently in place. And this might well have a significant impact in terms of the supply chain for data processing services in a number of different ways. Pricing of data processing contracts might be significantly increased to reflect costs of governance, potentially DPOs, changes to contractual terms and arrangements. The important point really is that any entity processing data needs to understand the new obligations and take steps to ensure that they've reviewed their contracts with data controllers, reviewed their use of subcontractors, and considered their own governance and organisational arrangements. Data controllers, of course, will need to be mindful of the changing contractual context for their relationship with data processors. So in a nutshell, that's the position of data processors. Turning now to the role of the data protection officer. This is one of the more controversial areas of the regulation, which has been subject to extensive debate. In particular, the importance of the DPO, the criteria for deciding who should have a DPO, and the nature of the obligations themselves. The provisions relating to DPOs are set out in Articles 37 to 39, and they represent a significant change in the law with practical ramifications for all public authorities and a number of private entities. So listen up. The current position under the previous directive is that there was no requirement to appoint a DPO, although, of course, many organisations do have individuals who perform a role of monitoring data protection compliance, training and advising on that issue. But there had been previously a wide divergence across member states as to how DPOs were used and for what purpose. The change affected by the regulation is that DPOs are now mandatory for certain bodies, although in my view it's highly regrettable that there is such a degree of uncertainty in relation to which bodies are subject to that mandatory obligation. So starting with who must appoint a DPO, both data controllers and data processors must appoint a DPO in certain circumstances. Now, initial drafts of the regulation had made this obligation mandatory for companies only once a certain threshold of numbers of employees had been met, to try to avoid too much of a burden on small businesses. However, Jan-Philipp Albrecht, the lead MEP in relation to the regulation, had suggested a change to that model, which focused not on employee numbers, but on how many data subjects' information was actually held by the entity. Now, there was lots of to-ing and fro-ing and going around the houses in relation to that, but ultimately, none of those restrictions are found in the regulation itself. And Article 35 sets out that the obligation to appoint a DPO applies to three categories of entity. One is where processing is carried out by a public authority or body, with an exception for the courts acting in their judicial capacity. The second is where the core activities of the controller or processor consist of processing operations, which, by virtue of their nature, their scope, and their purposes, require regular and systematic monitoring of data subjects on a large scale. Again, completely impossible Euro language that's going to have to be interpreted domestically. And the third is where there is the core activities consist of processing on a large scale of special categories of data, say data in Articles 9 and 10. So just turning to consider each of these briefly in turn, the definition of public authority or public body, which I know has been touched on briefly already, seems to me to create a significant amount of difficulty and is likely to lead to yet another debate that we've already had numerous times in numerous contexts of what public body actually means. Are we going to be in the territory of the EIRs and the Upper Tribunal's decision in Fish Legal? Or are we going to be in the context of something like Foster and British Gas and an approach where the CJEU would be looking at whether an entity was an emanation of the state? So, for example, is it providing public services? Does it have special powers that an individual would not have? Is a service under the control of the state? It seems to me that what the regulation is driving at is two categories of entity. Public authorities, which I might term core authorities, which would include government, local authorities, being your classic examples, and then other public bodies, which is this slightly more flexible, undefined approach, which might cover, for example, regulatory bodies, it might cover state-owned companies, for example, something like High Speed 2, it might cover, for example, utilities companies who have special powers and are effectively providing public services, but the boundaries of that are very unclear and will need to be worked out over the course of the coming few months and years. The second category also carries a degree of uncertainty as to what is meant by core activities and what is meant by regular and systematic monitoring. There's some assistance in Recital 97, which states that in the private sector, core activities relate to primary activities rather than ancillary activities. But that doesn't seem to me to be particularly helpful, because we've just replaced one definition with another, and it will inevitably be a judgment call when looking at the activities of the entity in the round. But it would seem to be directed to catch businesses who are in the business of online behaviour tracking or profiling activities. Again, the third category talks about core activities and large scale, again, very difficult definitions to apply in practice, in respect of special data, so Article 9 type data on political opinions, ethnic origin, etc., which seems to catch, for example, a cloud company who is offering to store patient records on behalf of a health authority, as an example. So there's a lot of work to be done in terms of unravelling those definitions. Importantly, though, it is no part of the regulation that each and every single entity has to have its own DPO. Article 37.2 sets out that a group of undertakings can appoint one data protection officer, provided that they're, quotes, easily accessible. So, for example, a large multinational company, which might have offices all over Europe, isn't necessarily required to have a single DPO in respect of each office, provided the relevant individual is easily accessible. And I think subject to the caveat that they are plainly going to have enough expertise to deal with their own national data protection law, in addition to member state data protection issues. There's a similar provision for public authorities in Article 37.3. You can appoint amongst a group of authorities a single DPO, having regard to your organisational structure and size. Of course, if that route is one that's gone down, there needs to be careful consideration to how issues of conflict might be dealt with and how instructions are going to be fed to and from the data protection officer, and how all of the substantive provisions, such as access to senior management, are going to be dealt with, where there are multiple entities in play. Finally, Article 37.4 clarifies that, of course, even where a DPO isn't required, there's discretion to have one. So whizzing through the duties of the DPO, there's not really much I can add other than just simply refer to the contents of Article 39. Plainly, the duties of a DPO are extensive, and they need to have a clear expert understanding of data protection law to be able to do these things, which range from internal advice about data protection obligations, monitoring compliance with data protection issues, both in terms of national law and the policies of the data controller itself, advising in respect of data impact assessments, which are dealt with in Article 35, and cooperating with the supervisory authority, which of course will be important where there's a data breach. So who will be suitable to be a DPO? Well, Article 37.5 states that they shall be designated on the basis of their professional qualities, and in particular, expert knowledge of data protection law and their ability to fulfil the task that I've just taken you through. It's clear that a DPO can be either an employee of your organisation or an external third party providing some DPO service. And I would imagine that we're going to see a number of those springing up over the recent months and years as demand for high-quality DPOs is only going to increase. Now, Recital 97 notes that the level of expert knowledge needs to be determined according to the data processing obligations carried out. So it's quite an organisation-specific requirement, looking at what you do, what type of data you process, and making sure that the DPO understands those issues. And whether or not they're an employee, they must be able to perform their duties in an independent manner. Now, the point about independence had been a subject of some concern in the past. What does that mean? Does it mean independent in the sense that they're not unduly influenced by employees or senior management? Or did independence mean that it would be very difficult to satisfy that if you're an employee of an entity? And you have to be completely independent from the organisation as a whole. Now, the latter is obviously unlikely because the regulation expressly contemplates that a DPO can be an employee. But obviously, careful consideration needs to be given to how someone can maintain their independence. Now, the regulation does not require that a DPO does only the role of a DPO. They can carry out other tasks, provided there's no conflict of interest. And that will be important for slightly smaller organisations where you don't want someone to fulfil a full-time DPO role, but you want them to be doing other things as well. Importantly, DPOs actually have a number of rights under the regulation, which are particularly important in terms of thinking about who you might appoint to the role. Article 38.2 provides that the controller and the processor have got to support the DPO in performing their tasks, giving them resources necessary to carry out those tasks and maintain their expert knowledge. There's going to have to be a degree of investment in the training of the individual in that role rather than just simply letting them sit and carry out their job without any support. Similarly, the DPO has got to have access to the company's data processing and personnel and operations, and they've got to have a direct reporting line to the highest management level. That's in Article 38.2.3. So again, important practical considerations and thinking about who might be performing this role. DPOs are also given protection from dismissal or penalisation for the performance of their tasks, which again, an important practical consideration when deciding whether it would be better to appoint your own DPO internally or whether it might be better to outsource that role to third parties. It all very much depends on the context as who might be suitable. So what are the practical implications? Well, of course, the regulation isn't in force yet, but many organisations will recognise that the regulation contains a number of onerous obligations in respect of DPOs, and there will be a certain amount of time required to prepare for that, not least to identify whether a DPO needs to be appointed. I think there are three key questions that you need to ask yourselves as an organisation. The first is, will you need a DPO? Now, for some, that will be easy. If you're a core public authority, a government body, a local authority, the answer is plainly yes. For others, that's going to be a more difficult judgment call based on your core activities, working out the definitions in the regulation. And it will be, as I say, a much more difficult issue. if you do need a DPO, the second question that you need to ask yourself is, if you don't already have one, or even if you do, where's that person going to come from, and are they going to have the right expertise? Of course, an internal appointment might be appropriate. Many companies and organisations already have highly experienced and highly qualified DPOs, which will simply be able to step into this role, while for others it will be a totally new venture, and companies and entities need to start planning resourcing requirements on that front. If the role is going to be outsourced, then consideration needs to be given to this. It's likely there's going to be a shortage of experienced DPOs, so start thinking now about how best to recruit or train relevant individuals. And the third and final point is there a case for sharing a DPO with any other organisation, parent or subsidiary companies, other smaller businesses, or indeed other types of public sector organisations? So whilst there is a degree of uncertainty about the future of data protection in light of Brexit, I think what is certain is that there is much to be gained by understanding the changes in respect of data processes and planning ahead to make the necessary provision for DPOs. So that concludes my talk. I'm now going to hand over to Rupert Payne to deal with cross-border data sharing.